She thought his smile might kill her. "You're crying. And besides, I've had strange dreams."
"If there was any other way."
"Perhaps I wouldn't have been born."
"We have little time," she said through her tears. "You'll need to meet me tomorrow where the West Road runs into the Blackwoods Road on its way to the city. How soon can you get there?"
"By mid-morning, or not long after."
"You must invent some reason for leaving. Tell as few as possible and depart without an audience. Say you go anywhere but to the city. Travel light and as fast as you can without drawing undue attention. Let no one see your sorrow."
"I understand."
"I'll see you tomorrow, then."
"Tomorrow," he said, still smiling. And out of love was the one who broke the link. Some time later, after she'd won back composure, she again reached out to Gilda through the rich green stone that kept them in contact. Nearly 10 long minutes ticked by before their connection was made.
"Sorry, sorry," said Gilda, flustered. "I was with a customer. I couldn't get away."
"No matter, Gilda. My friend, I have a task for you. And not to plunge you into deep dismay, I must say this. Upon your success lies the future of our kingdom."
The link between them trembled with Gilda's uncertainty, then firmed again.
"Of course, Vera. What do you need?"
"I'm coming into the city for the execution, and I need you to save me bench space for three beside you, right down the front, directly before the block."
"Beside me?" said Gilda, faltering. "So close?"
"Yes. Can you do it?"
"Of course."
"Bless you, dear. I'll see you before midnight this Barrel's Day."
She replaced Gilda's stone and selected another, this one dark blue-black.
"Rogan, I have a task for you."
Rogan agreed without question, as she'd known he would. Next, she contacted Lainey Treadwell, whose family business was most useful, and finally she reached out to the 10 best-placed and strongest magicians in the group, on whose shoulders she must place a heavy burden. Resolute, they promised to join her in Dorana and carry out their task. Javale bless them all. Without such staunch supporters, she'd not have the heart to go on. With all the arrangements in place, and tired almost beyond speaking, she replaced the last circle stone, the hidey-hole lid, and the carpet that covered them, eased herself groaning to her feet, and went out to the kitchen. The soup was on the stovetop, bubbling aromatically. Daphne and Matthias sat in silence at the table, each lost in private meditation.
"Please, Vera, what's going on?" said Daphne, looking up. "The herbs you had Matt cut for you
are deadly," she said shortly. "I know it."
Matthias stirred in his chair.
"Then why do you need them?"
She moved to the kitchen window and stared out into the garden beyond, with its undisciplined winter roses and riot of ravenberries.
"To serve prophecy."
"Serve it how?"
said Daphne.
"I'll keep my own counsel on that. The less you know, the better. At least until you must."
"And who decides when that is? I'm not a child, Vera, whatever you like to call me. I'm Javale's heir and..."
"And you'll learn to follow another's instructions," she snapped,
turning away from the window. Then, seeing Daphne's strained and peaky face, seeing the fear imperfectly smothered, she softened.
"Child, child, for that's what you are to me, married lady or not. Stop fretting on things you don't control. We've enough worms in the apple without you making room for more."
Daphne looked to Matthias, who shook his head and ventured a brief smile.
"No fretching, remember?"
Defeated, Daphne slumped.
"All right. Good,"
Vera said briskly, and moved to the stove.
"Now let's eat."
Afterwards, once the soup had been consumed in silence, and Matthias was sent outside to check Bessie, her shoes, her harness, and the rackety old cart, Daphne turned her hand to washing dishes. "I'm not fratching, truly," she said, her hands in soapy water. "I just wish you'd tell me who those herbs are for." Vera sighed. Letting the dish towel dangle from her finger, she said,
"No one you know, child, I promise."
"But someone you know?" Grimly, she held her tears below the surface.
"Yes, someone I know."
"Then let me brew the potion." Oh, it was a tempting thought. Kind and loving, too.
"No,"
she said, and touched her hand to Daphne's shoulder.
"Though you have my thanks for offering."
Mettlesome as always, Daphne took the refusal as criticism.
"I am capable. I have more herb lore than..." "Herb lore has nothing to do with it. No woman with child should touch those cuttings."
Shocked silent, Daphne stared at her, pulled her hands from the soapy dishwater to flatten them against her belly and press, softly.
"With child? What do you mean?"
Vera snorted.
"I'm old, child, not blind or deaf or stupid. I might not have birthed my own, but I've done my share of midwifery over the years. There's a look a woman gets, and I felt something different in you too."
Then she sighed.
"You didn't realize?"
Daphne shook her head.
"No, at least, I wondered, for a moment. But I can't be. We only lay together twice, and I took precautions both times." "Then could be prophecy has other ideas."
"Why? What good can come of this?"
Vera reached for another plate to dry.
"There's always good in the birth of a baby."
"When our world's about to end in flood and fire? How?"
"Perhaps to remind us not to give up so easily."
"I'm not giving up,"
said Daphne, stepping back. Soap suds dripped heedless to the floor.
"I'm lost. I'm frightened. I used to trust myself, trust prophecy, to believe I was given what I needed to prevail. Instead, I'm a fugitive, and the man I was born to guide and protect awaits his death. And now there's a baby?"
The child was losing hope. Time for a little sharp prodding.
"In other words, you are giving up."
Daphne turned away.
"Perhaps I am," she whispered roughly. "Perhaps it's the best thing I can do for all of us. Give up. Walk away. Leave his fate to those who've not made such terrible mistakes."
"I doubt that's best for Asher or his babe,"
said Vera, and put a snap in her voice.
"You're Javel's heir, Daphne. You cannot walk away. And besides, who amongst us has never made a mistake? Not me. Not Matthias either. Making mistakes isn't the problem, child. It's not doing our best to fix them after that leads to ruin. And we don't know there's been any mistakes. Could be all of this is what prophecy planned from the beginning."
"Then prophecy should have thought of a different plan,"
Daphne retorted, flushing with temper. Then she turned back to the sink, seeking refuge in housewifery.
"You haven't told Matt about this, have you?"
Raising an eyebrow, Vera held out her hand for the next dripping bowl.
"Could be he already knows. Handled enough pregnant mares in his time, hasn't he?"
"Well, he hasn't handled me."
"Peace. I've not told him, child,"
she said gently.
"And I won't. Time and your belly will tell him soon enough. And he's got himself a full plate already, I'm thinking. I don't need to force-feed him anything more to chew on."
Daphne nodded, frowning, and reached for the soup pot to scrub. "We're going back to the city, aren't we?" she said after a moment. "To try and rescue Asher." "Well, not we." But she was too tired for more arguments, at least right now. So instead of telling Daphne the truth, she said,
Yes, later tonight, after dark. But there'll be no trying about it. The innocent mage will be rescued, and prophecy will continue.
Asher was dragged from a wonderful dream of Daphne by the sound of banging hammers. Cursing, he rolled painfully onto his other side, closed his eyes and tried to recapture sleep. She'd been in a green and sweetly smelling place, her fragrant hair unbound, her thin face lit with a smile. There were trees all around her, and pigs, and hens. He opened his eyes. Pigs and hens? Baal bloody save him, he was finally going mad. With some of the novelty worn off, enough of the crowd had returned home or to their temporary lodgings in the city's hotels and hostelries for him to see what all the hammering was about. Brawny palace staff were building a dais on the left-hand side of the square. Oxbunder, condemned to guard duty, noticed him noticing and leered in typically unfriendly fashion. Probably he was grudging, because now he'd never get paid that 3 trins owed to him from their last game of darts down at the Goose. Ha! Praise Baal for small favours. Ox wandered over, planted his pikestaff like a walking stick and leaned.
Going to be a big crowd to see you get your comeuppance midnight tomorrow, he remarked. I hear the general councillors are near to drawing straws to see who gets the best view from up on that dais they're building. I hear Guildmeister Roddle's been offering money to make sure he's seated right down the very front.
If he said nothing, Ox would stop leaning and hit him with a pikestaff. If he said something, anything, Ox would stop leaning and... He sighed. Midnight tomorrow, eh? He answered, as though he didn't know. You reckon it's going to rain? Ox stopped leaning and hit him with the pikestaff. Spitting blood and a broken tooth, Asher rolled his face into his folded arms and took refuge once more in sleep. He didn't dream this time of pigs or hens or Daphne or anyone else at all. Blessedly alone in Conroy's townhouse, with Aetean at long last noisily departed, the household staff dismissed and Willa sent to oversee arrangements for the impending Ulcan curfew, Morg sat in a chair in Conroy's library and gave himself over to thought. The weather orb, dutifully delivered, sat in its box on a table before him. Teasing. Taunting. Tantalizing. All that magic but a thin skin's thickness away. There had to be a way to get at it. Imprisoned within, Conroy raged. Unlike Derm, whose guilt-stained soul had wept and wailed and begged Baal for mercy, for aid, Conroy seemed more affronted than anything to find himself captive inside his own body. The first shock passed, he now jabbered ceaselessly in the background, demanding explanations, insisting upon answers, offering help. Help? The fool! To think Morg required the help of a sheep, that he was in any position to bargain, wheedle, make deals, arrangements. Morg reached out and stroked the orb. Its quiescent colours swirled. Sensing him, rejecting him. His flesh belonged to Conroy, but the spirit within was his own. The orb would never give him access. Never. Unless... An idea, glimmering. A flickered spark of inspiration. He held his breath, lest even a gentle exhalation extinguish hope. Could it be managed? Was it possible? Could Morg and Conroy merge into a single entity just long enough for the orb not to recognize Baal's bitter enemy? To grant him her weather magics, that he might use them to bring down her wall? It would never have worked using Derm. Even with all his maudlin despair, the fat fool had been far too strong, and their minds, at the core, were ultimately incompatible. The only way to control him had been to keep him safely, rigorously caged. Letting him out, even a little, would have been fatal. But Conroyd, Conroyd, here was a soul of a different stripe, one with faint echoes of his own darkness. Even better, he and Conroyd were blood-related, ties of family whispering down the centuries. They belonged in each other, as he and Derm had never belonged. And Conroyd was accepted by Baal. Sitting back, closing his eyes, he reached inside and touched small Conroyd's mind, gentle as sunshine. "You desire to help me, cousin? You wish to sip from the cup of power only I can hold to your lips?" Little Conroyd whimpered, suddenly uncertain. "Have no fear, blood of my blood. You were born for greatness, born to raise the Doranan to the heights of all known mastery. Help me, and together we shall birth an age of glory never before known in this land." Little Conroyd's greed and ambition flared like a torch at midnight. "Come to me, Conroyd," he whispered. "Let us mingle for a moment." Conroyd came to him, unthinking and unaware. Morg lowered the bars of the cage around him. Let him out. Let him breathe. And at the same instant, breathed him in. Melted Conroyd like butter and soaked him through all his nooks and crannies, flavoring his spirit with the essence of Geralt, hiding himself like a fox evading hounds in running water. Conroyd shrieked once and was silent. Time passed. At length, something not quite Conroyd, not quite Morg, sat upright in its cradling chair, removed the weather orb from its wooden box and held it in its hands. Sighing, it smiled at the glorious swirl of colour, the promise it held of death and destruction, the spell required to transfer the magic from orb to waiting mind remained a legacy from Derm. All it needed to do now was recite the words, trigger the act of transference, steal the bitch whore's precious power. The part of this new thing that was Morg took a moment to prepare, to ensure that he continued safely entwined with Conroyd. Satisfied, he sank beneath the surface again, and the thing held up the orb before its shining eyes, spoke the words of the transference incantation, and waited for victory. Within the orb the colour swirled, deepened, took on luster in life. The creature watched, exultant, as they poured out of the orb and over its hands, into its hands, as they sank inside it, filling it with knowledge, with power, with the key to this kingdom's destruction. And then, hesitation. The pulsing orb trembled, the colours shifted, darkened. Crimson and gold changed to purple and black and began writhing as though alive, furious and in pain. Baal's long-dead voice cried, "No, no, this is not for you, Morg, never for you!" But still the orb tried to empty itself of magic, sensing yet the presence of an untainted vessel. The thing surged to its feet, howling, as the flesh of its fingers seared, sizzled, as the darkness inside the orb flooded outside, up its arms and over its body like a wave of foul black ink. Morg wrenched himself free from Conroyd's clawing presence, threw back his head and screamed in furious desperation, "Bitch! Whore! You won't keep them from me again, Baal!
I will have them!
No, Morgan, a whispering voice replied. No, you will not.
The orb burst into flame. Within heartbeats, the air in the library was thickened with the stench of charred flesh and charred magic. Morg screamed and dropped the ruined orb. It fell to the floor and smashed into pieces. He collapsed a moment later, crushing its blackened shards to powder beneath his convulsing body as oblivion came to claim him. It was Darren who found the diary. Fussing fusspot Darren with his passion for order and symmetry, his determination that things must be just so. His busy fingers felt the irregular thickness in the aged leather binding of a text on primer exercises for junior magicians. His critical eyes saw the difference between the front and back covers and made him wonder. Sitting beside him on the study floor, Gar slit the book's apparently untouched stitching with his dagger and eased the diary out of hiding, held it in his hands that trembled and wondered if he was dreaming.
"Baal save us," breathed Darren, astonished. "There really is a diary."
Baal save them indeed, and in her own words no less, if the diary was truly once hers. Was it the miracle he'd been waiting for, hoping for, believing in against all expectation of fulfillment? If it wasn't, it was the closest thing he'd found. He let the diary fall open, stared at the swift, untidy writing, the faded ink strokes, the imprints of history. Struggling, he made sense of the first few lines. "It saddens me to think of the magics we must leave behind, but in this new land magic must be a thing of order and discipline, not an everyday indulgence or..."
"Gracious," said Darren, peering. "It looks like a lot of old chicken scratchings. Do you think you can read it, sir?"
Gar let his fingertips caress the page, inhaled the scent of musty dust and thyme, feeling hope's candle flare. He smiled. "Yes, I can read it." Darren released a gusty sigh.
"Praise Baal for small mercies," he said. "But might I suggest you read it later? The king's men will be here soon, wanting these books, and for once I'm inclined to believe what Willa says. We don't want to keep them waiting."
So he hid the diary at the back of a bookshelf and hurried to help Darren pack away the rest of Derm's collected life and learnings. When they were done, and the books, papers, and journals were neatly boxed and stacked by the tower's front doors, he made himself stand still in the middle of the tiled foyer floor for a moment and breathe. Just breathe.
"What now, sir?" said Darren.
"Now?" He shook his head to clear it, wiped away sweat with his forearm. "Now I have work, Darren. And if Baal is merciful and truly hears our prayers, there'll be something in these pages that can not only save this kingdom, but Asher as well."
"Then you'd better get started, sir," said Darren. "And have no fear. I'll see you're not distracted or disturbed."
Gar spared him a quick smile. "Good man." As Darren's tired, drawn face lit up with an answering smile, Gar turned and headed for the spiral staircase, took it 3 treads at a time, thinking,
"Please, Baal, please, be merciful, just this once."
Chapter 27 Pelin Oryk sat at his desk and frowned at the reports spread before him. No sign, no sign, no sign. Daphne the bookseller and Gar's former stablemeister, Matt, were nowhere to be found. He drummed his fingers on the desktop and frowned more deeply. What did their disappearance mean? Was it a coincidence? Unlikely. Were they merely dismayed that their friend had been revealed as a traitor? possible? Or were they mired hip-deep in blasphemy beside him, and desperate now to save their own wicked lives? Also possible. Maybe even probable. Which meant King Conroyd was right, and this was a conspiracy. It was a horrifying thought, with implications and consequences too dreadful to imagine, except that he was the captain of the city, and it was his job, his duty, to imagine them. Chilled, Oryk sat back in his chair and stared out of the window towards the square. He could just see the top of Ash's cage over the press of bodies still gathered to marvel and gloat. With the word gone out to all and sundry on his crime and imminent death, the city was as full of visitors now as it had been during the month of mourning for the late royal family. The inns were full again, the hotels too, and all the rustic hostelries. Death was a booming business these days. Conspiracy. How far did its tentacles spread then? How deeply was its rotten abscess buried within the flesh of Ulcan society, and how much blood would be shed in the attempt to cut it out? Would ashes be sufficient? Or must the guards of the kingdom unite to spill blood enough to make a river? Starting with Daphne's and Stablemeister Matt's. Abruptly sickened, Oryk left his office, left the guardhouse, and made his way across the square to Asher in his cage. The four guards on duty dipped their heads in polite greeting and withdrew as far as they could to give him privacy. He addressed the prisoner without preamble.
Your friends Daphne and Matt are missing. If you love them, tell me where they would go so I might bring them in sensibly and ask them myself how they assisted in your crimes.
Asher's eyes were dark-rimmed and sunken, and all his wounds had festered. Without bothering to lift his head or look up at all, he croaked,
"Piss off, Pelin."
Despite the vile stench from the cage, the straw, Asher's unwashed body, Oryk stepped closer.
"If I tell the king I can't find them, he'll order a reckless search. Innocent people might be hurt or arrested for all the wrong reasons. In the end, you know they'll be found, Asher. There's nowhere they can run to or hide where I or someone like me won't find them. And then it won't be me and mine asking the questions. It'll be His Majesty. And you know best how that will go. So tell me where they are. Not for me or him. For them."
Now Asher did stir and look up.
"I don't know where they are in any road. They were never involved, and Geralt knows it. If he wants them, it's to hurt me. Now, Telts, not that you'd care."
"That's untrue!"
Asher laughed, a harsh and rasping rattle.
"Is it? You think you have cause for complaint?"
Lifting one raw and weeping wrist, jangling the chains that bound him, for the first time Asher looked him full in the face.
"Wouldn't you? You don't think you deserve this? You don't think it's fair? Why not? You were eager enough for justice when it was Timon Spakeface and the axe."
Asher flinched.
"Timon Spake was never hurt with magic. You didn't chain him up like an animal, or put him on show like an animal. For all he was a criminal, you treated Timon Spake with decency."
Oryk clenched his jaw, offended by more than just the stink.
"I take my duty seriously, Asher. Your arrest is lawful, your guilt beyond doubt. You admitted your crime. However..."
He tightened his hands behind his back and lowered his voice.
"If the choice were mine, you'd have awaited execution in the guardhouse."
"Really?" said Asher.
"Well, I guess that means we're friends again, eh?"
He looked away.
"We were never friends!"
"I know," said Asher softly.
"But we might have been."
This was a mistake. tugging his tunic straight, Oryk said briskly, "Reconsider your silence on Daphne and Matt. The longer they stay fugitive, the harder I must search for them, and the worse things will be once they're found. If they're innocent..."
"Innocent?" said Asher. "There ain't no innocent here, Pellin. Our new King Conroy's got the bit between his teeth now. He's bolting towards turning all us Olkin into cattle, and if you can't see that, you're blinder than I thought. You let him get his hands on Daphne or Matt, it'll just be the start. Next thing you know, anyone who ever smiled at him will be under suspicion. You wait. It's all rolling downhill from here."
"And if it is," said Oryk, "who's to blame for that? Who is the one caught dabbling with magic?"
Asher slumped into his filthy straw, frowned at his manacled wrists.
"I know. For the love of Baal, Asher, tell me where they are. You might be saving their lives."
"You are blind," said Asher, and closed his bloodshot eyes. "Blind and bloody stupid. The best hope they've got is if I never mention their names again. So I won't. Now piss off, why don't you? I'm a very busy man."
Rebuffed, nonplussed, grudgingly moved and resentful of that, Oryk stood there for a moment, just staring at him. Then he turned on his heel and went back to the guardhouse. The new king awaited his report, and he had yet to decide what it would say. Conroy's townhouse was filling with shadows when Morg returned to himself. He felt pain, confusion, a bizarre disorientation, as though he were trying to be two people at once. For some time he remained on the floor, struggling to piece together what had happened. The memory of Baal's voice sighed through his pounding head. He lifted his hands before his eyes and stared. Charred flesh, blistered meat. Revolted, he healed himself with a word and sat up. Baal's voice faded, chased away by buzzing Conroyd. He sank inside, retrieved all the melted thinness of himself, and banished Conroyd deep within. And felt different. Startled, as he had not been startled in centuries, he examined the difference. What was it? What did it mean? Was he still himself? Or had Baal's attack damaged him somehow? Damn Baal! Had he loved her? Worshipped her? Wanted to spend eternity with her? He must have been mad. Subduing the flesh emotion, he waited for his startlement to pass. Conjured Glimfire and considered himself. His surroundings. His beautiful clothes were smeared and stained. The weather orb! Crumbled to ash and memory, ground into the carpet beneath him. Almost, almost, he wept. More time passed. Self-control returned and intellect reasserted itself. Yes. The orb was destroyed, and with it his hope for a swift victory. But at least no other Dorinan would have the weather magics now, and use them to keep Baal's golden wall strong. And when Asher died, the last living weather magic would die along with him. But failure to gain it for himself and his own ends meant he was still trapped here. Must wait weeks, months for the magics to fade and the wall to collapse beneath the weight of its gradual decay. And waiting meant he must somehow keep the other Dorinan at bay, his borrowed body safe, until victory came limping to him. Assaulted, intellect trembled. It was intolerable. Intolerable! He staggered to his feet, healed hands clenched into fists, opened his mouth to shout aloud his fury, frustration, and lingering pain. and gasped. There was new magic in his mind. Tentatively, he reached towards it, brushed his senses against it, feeling it slowly unfurl, and laughed.
Weather magic.
Not complete, not all that had been contained in the orb had passed to him, and what had escaped Baal's clutches was damaged now by the black flames, but it was weather magic all the same. This must be the difference he had felt. This, his longed-for victory.
See, bitch!
He shouted to the empty room, to a lingering, vanquished memory.
You did not beat me! You have not won!
He now possessed just enough weather magic to let him see into the heart of her precious wall, to show him its weft and warp, and how he might tease its threads undone. Tease at the fabric of her genius, unravel it, and so unravel the world she'd made in defiance of him and the sacred vows they'd sworn to one another. But not here. For such deep seeing, he required the weather chamber. He rode there on the back of Peasant Asher's silver stallion. Like its former master, the animal resisted him at first, but not for long. Nothing and no one could resist him for long. He travelled the city streets unnoticed, cloaked in a spell of distraction, entered the palace grounds unremarked by the guards, and turned the stallion's head towards the old palace grounds, where Baal's final monstrosity squatted amongst the trees. The closer he got to the chamber, the more strongly he could smell it. 6 centuries dead, and her magic continued to hold sway. He hated her, and marvelled at her mastery. Breaking through the trees at last, he found himself in a clearing, face to face with the ancient weather chamber, bastion of Baal's magic and seat of his undoing. Teeth gritted, he dismounted and looped the stallion's reins over a handy branch. Lathered, pocked with spur marks, the animal drooped its head to the ground, panting and dripping bloody sweat. After conjuring Glimfire, he opened the reluctant door and climbed the stairs 2 at a time, reveling in his athletic ease. The door at the top of the stairs was open. He shoved it wider, stepped into the chamber, and was once more soaked with the drenching stench of Baal's weather magic. Faint echoes of her presence stirred like fading, rancid perfume. He tipped back his head, stared through the crystal ceiling and into the gold-washed sky.
"Do you see me, bitch?" he whispered. "It's Morgan, dearest. Your husband's home."
Unanswered, he turned his attention to the centre of the chamber and the sympathetic model of Lur so skilfully turned to the fabric of the kingdom. An unfamiliar emotion speared him. Regret. The map was a miracle only Baal could manage.
Oh, what they might have accomplished if only she'd stayed faithful.
Sinking to the parquetry floor, he stretched out his hands above the model, closed his eyes and opened his mind to the stolen incantations that writhed in his head like golden snakes, letting Baal's stinking magic suffuse him. And then, at last, he understood. Everything that until this moment had been opaque was perfectly, beautifully clear. He understood it all. In this fecund land, power flows through all living things, a part of them and indivisible, not hard and sharp and brilliant like Doran and magic, to be forged into weapons and servitude. Olkin magic is soft and slithery, nourishing like blood, destined to slip through the fingers of any who might think to crudely grasp it.
Baal sees this, accepts this, comes to realize that her purpose requires a marriage of magics. Night and day she labors to give the union life and so protect her new home forever. In the weather lies the key. She weaves magic like a tapestry, combining Ulkan and Doranan power into whole cloth. This thread for rainfall, that thread for snow. Here the color of sunshine, there the shadows of wind. The power builds, feeding into the wall she is creating, flowing from it to the fertile earth and back to the wall again. It is an endless cycle of give and take, replenish and diminish and replenish once more. An act never-ending, demanding an endless sacrifice, and at its heart lies the weather worker, living conduit of power and pain. The weather worker is the weaver, with the walls separate and delicate skeins threading through fragile fingers of flesh and bone. The weather worker controls the magic, is the magic, weaves the tapestry, maintains the wall, constantly creates and keeps the balance between Ulkan and Doranan powers. And woe to Baal's beloved kingdom should the weather worker snap a thread. Morg opened his eyes, struggling to remember how to breathe, blinked and blinked and blinked again until the chamber resolved itself into the familiarity of hard lines and solid surfaces. Before him pulsed the map of the kingdom, its beating, vulnerable heart, which now he had the means to crush. With the stolen weather magics incomplete, he would be forced to move slowly. Torture! After interminable waiting, he longed to rip Baal's wall to pieces with teeth and taloned fingers, sink his power into its entrails and gut it like a rabbit, fall upon the magic-soaked model map and pound it to splinters with his fists, grind it to powder beneath his heels. But no. Confined in flesh, denied access to his untrammeled powers and her complete incantations, he must still bide his time. Pick apart his dear Baal's tapestry, thread by slow and sticky thread. Wait a little longer before being reunited with the best and most of himself, held in limbo on the other side of the wall. Morg smiled and soothed himself. Patience, patience. After these 6 centuries, what were a few weeks more? By the time the hour came for them to leave the cottage, bent on Dorana and Asha's rescue, Daphne was almost numb with fatigue and dread. Filled with the churning horror, reminded sickeningly of Tim and Spake and the Orus Root, she'd sat in the kitchen and watched Vera concoct her poisonous potion. 7 different plants were used. Drogul, witch eye, lantern, dogsbane and bloodweed she recognized. The other 3 she'd never seen before and didn't dare query. 1 word out of place and she knew Vera would banish her from the room. And this wasn't something the old woman should do on her own, even if all the help she'd accept was a silent, sympathetic witnessing. Once the poison was mixed, poured carefully into a small jar, stoppered and wrapped 2 times against spillage, Vera disposed of the leftover muck and went to walk in the forest again. With Matt still pottering outside and not needing help, he said, Daphne went back indoors, pulled a book from one of Vera's shelves and curled up in an armchair to read. But couldn't. Her hand kept drifting to her belly, and her thoughts wouldn't turn from the miracle, the mistake, whatever Vera said, now growing deep inside her. A baby. A baby. A baby. What was prophecy thinking? What did she think?
As Chevelle's heir, she'd never imagined becoming a mother, not even a wife, given the danger of the life she lived. The last married heir had died unhappily 200 years ago, nearly. Daphne had taken that lesson to heart and sworn never to risk herself or her duty in the name of frivolous love. But then had come Asher, and suddenly love didn't seem so frivolous. Love without warning became as needful as air. Would he be pleased to discover he'd soon enough be a father? Would she even have the chance to tell him? If this rescue failed, if evil triumphed. No, she wouldn't let doubt touch her. They'd rescue Asher unharmed. Prophecy wouldn't let it be otherwise. She'd see him again, and he would forgive her the lies and the silences. And when his task for prophecy was done, they'd settle down and be a family in the brand new lure they'd helped create. Tears prickled, blurring her eyes. She was going to have a baby. Outside the cottage, shadows lengthened. Dusk descended. Matt came inside looking for dinner. She put the book back on its shelf and gave him some carrots to peel. Vera returned with 2 fresh rabbits already gutted, skinned, and jointed. She set them to frying in butter and sage, and so night fell upon them. With dinner eaten and the dishes done, Vera announced they'd depart at midnight, then retired to a bedroom. Matt retired to his. Daphne returned to the sitting room, tried again to read, gave up, and blew out the lantern to sleep a little before they had to leave. Sleep eluded her. Eyes open or closed, all she could see was that bottle of poison and the look on Vera's face as she'd stoppered it. Terrible sorrow. Dreadful resolve. For Asher to be rescued, someone had to die. The thought was appalling, haunted her unmercifully so that she gave up the idea of slumber and ventured back to the kitchen instead. Vera was packing bread and cheese and biscuits into a rough weave hamper.
There you are, child. I was about to come and rouse you. Matt's outside, harnessing Bessie.
Good, she said, and looked for a mug. Is there time for tea? There was the slightest hesitation as Vera searched the drawer for a bread knife.
Not for me and Matthias. We must leave in the next 1/4 hour.
She looked up. And me? Straightening, knife in hand, Vera shook her head.
No, Daphne, you're staying behind.
Behind? I don't think so. Stay here alone while you and Matt run all the risks of rescue?
You won't be alone, said Vera. You'll have the pigs for company, and the hens too. Don't forget to feed them, or they'll raise a mighty ruckus. Few things as tetchy as pigs and hens if they're made to go to bed without their supper.
Vera!
It's too dangerous, child. You know they'll be looking for you.
And for Matt, she protested. But he's going back, so why can't I?
Breathing deeply, Vera tucked the bread knife into the basket.
It's best if you don't. I've a little trick practiced to keep the guards from spotting Matthias, but I'm not strong enough to play it on both of you.
Then show it to me and I'll play it on myself.
No,
said Vera flatly, and kept on packing the basket.
No,
she echoed, and felt a flooding rage.
I am Javale's heir. You don't say no to me, old woman.
The kitchen's back door opened, revealing Matt.
Don't flatter her, Daphne. If she says you can't come, accept it.
She turned on him, venomous.
Not without a damned good reason.
That earned her a scorching look from Vera.
Because I say so is reason enough. You may be Javale's heir, but prophecy brought you here, and here is where I'm in charge. So hold your tongue if you've nothing of use to say with it, and finish off stocking that basket. It's a long trip back to the city, and we'll have no time for stopping on the way.
That said, Vera stalked out of the kitchen. Quietly cursing, Daphne did as she was told, flinging biscuits and fruit scones from their tin onto a clean cloth, and then into the basket, lifting hard-boiled eggs from their saucepan on the stove and tossing them in after. Hotly aware of scrutiny, she looked up and met Matt's understanding gaze.
"Vera's right," he said, still standing in the doorway and letting the cold air in. "She's a circle guardian. We must be guided by her, no matter how hard that is."
"Vera's a bossy old besom, and don't you try telling me otherwise."
His lips quirked in a tiny smile.
"Actually, she reminds me of you."
"Did I ask your opinion?"
He sighed.
"No, so I won't give it. And since the wagon's ready, I'm off to harness Bessie."
"Fine,"
she muttered through gritted teeth as the door banged shut behind him.
"I hope she stands on all your toes and breaks them."
"Not a very charitable wish, child,"
chided Vera from the other doorway. A padded dark blue coat was folded over her arm.
"You ride too roughshod over that young man."
Daphne felt her face warm. "He's got broad shoulders," she said defensively. "He can carry a few harsh words from me."
"It's not if he can," said Vera. "It's if he should, and we both know the answer to that."
Abandoning the basket, Daphne dropped into the nearest kitchen chair, watching as Vera put down the coat she carried and picked up the swaddled bottle of poison from the benchtop. The old woman's expression was unbearably sad. Abruptly, anger died.
"Vera, don't take that with you. Rescue Asher without it."
"We can't," said Vera, not looking around. "This is the way it has to be. One life for another."
"Why? It's murder!"
Three of Vera's hairpins were coming loose. She put down the poison and poked and prodded them back into place.
"It's sacrifice. There's a difference."
"Asher wouldn't like what you're planning, Vera. He wouldn't want to be rescued like this. I know him, and he wouldn't want it."
Vera turned, her kindly wrinkled face now hard with purpose.
"I don't much care for what he wants, child, or what you want either. This is about prophecy, not personal desires. You may have forgotten that, but others haven't."
The barb was unexpected. For a moment she could hardly breathe, let alone speak.
"That's unfair."
A scornful snort.
"Life's unfair, child."
Which was, unfortunately, true. She picked up the thread of her original argument, loath to let it go.
"As Javel's heir, I should be coming with you. Please, Vera, don't make me stay behind."
Vera shook her head.
"Behind is where you belong."
It was like telling a tree not to grow, or the sun to rise upside down. Pointless. But that didn't stop her from trying. "But Vera, I need to be there. Asher might not trust you or Matt. He will trust me." With a sharp sigh, Vera took a step closer.
"Child, child, emotion is addling your wits. What wise housewife puts all her eggs in one basket? Should this rescue fail, should we be discovered or prophecy thwarted somehow by the darkness struggling to defeat us, you must pick up the circle's pieces. You must become heir and guardian both. In my bedroom, on my dresser, I've left you instructions. Should the worst befall us, follow them exactly. Do what you can to save as many as possible. Save yourself. Bear your child. For it, too, is a part of prophecy's plans, and doubtless has some grand destiny whose purpose we still don't know."
All without warning, Daphne felt herself flooded with tears.
"Damn!"
Vera's eyes were brimming, too.
Have faith, child. Trust in prophecy. Between us, Matthias and Raphael and I will bring your Asher home.
Raphael?
She whispered. Vera nodded.
The man we go to meet on the way.
The man who would soon die. Had she really wanted a name? Yes, but now she regretted knowing it. Names were real. Names belonged to the living and called to mind the dead. Feeling unsteady, she forced herself to her feet.
When you reach this Raphael, tell him thank you. Tell him I'm sorry. Tell him I wish there was another way.
Solemn, sorrowful, Vera reached out her hand and touched cold fingertips to her cheek.
I will, child. For all of us.
Daphne looked so forlorn, so abandoned, as she stood waving them goodbye from the cottage's front gate, that Matt almost asked Vera to reconsider and let her come with them after all. But only almost, because he was in truth quite glad she wasn't coming, was instead left safe behind in the middle of the Black Woods, where no harm would come to her if this mad plan to rescue Asher fell all to pieces, as it seemed most likely it would. Sunk equally deep in blankets and silence, Vera sat beside him on the little wagon's bench seat and let him get on with the driving. Bessie, a good-natured animal, seemed quite happy to venture out in the dark. Didn't take much driving at all, just the occasional hup, hup, and rattle of reins to keep her up to the bridle as she jog, walk, jogged along the empty road. For that, he felt a little sorry. More energetic driving would give him less empty time to think about things he'd rather not consider. Vera still hadn't revealed the details of this trip. All she'd said was they'd be traveling without stop until they reached Dorina, except for picking up someone else from the circle. Someone, he suspected, he'd not long have the chance to know. It was just one of the many things he didn't want to think about. Slowly, steadily, the miles unrolled behind them. The night grew colder, marching toward sunrise, and he wrapped an extra blanket round his shoulders, held the reins in one hand so he could warm the other in his armpit, and swapped them over time and again. Eventually, the morning came. Vera stirred and fed them from the basket. They were well along the Blackwoods Road now. Sheep grazed on either side, and rabbits scuttled white-tailed as they creaked on by, but otherwise they were quite alone. Vera ordered him into the back of the wagon to stretch out and sleep properly. Happy to obey her, he lay down, tucked the blankets around him, and fell into a dreamless oblivion. She woke him some little time later, and he sat up, stiff and yawning. They stopped long enough to take turns ducking behind some convenient bushes, eat a little more and give the pony a short rest, and then resumed their travelling. The sun had climbed almost to 10 o'clock when they reached the West Road intersect, where a man stood patiently with his eyes shaded, staring in their direction. At first, ridiculously, Matt thought it was Asher, and his hands tightened on the reins. Beside him, having a rest from driving and dozing with her eyes half closed, Vera tapped him on the knee and said,
"No, it's not him, but looks-wise it could be."
He nodded, feeling suddenly ill. He was beginning to make out the bones of this rescue.
"And that's why you chose him?"
"Prophecy chose him, Matthias, not me."
Vera sighed.
"Does it ever make your blood run cold with wonder? That we're in dire trouble, needing some kind of a miracle, and here's a young man who looks like another young man, near enough to be his mirror self, or a brother. And he's one of us, and willing to say, 'Take me to do what's needed.'"
He swallowed bile.
"Everything about this business makes my blood run cold. I doubt if it's with wonder. How well do you know him, this young man?
It took Vera a little time to answer. She smoothed the sleeves of her padded coat, tucked her hair behind her ears, then tugged it free again, chewed on a ragged fingernail, making it worse. He waited, not patient, but knowing he hadn't a choice.
His name is Raphael, and I know him well enough. His mother was my youngest sister, Vera said at last, sighing again. When Timon Spake died, and then his father Edward, the circle required a new member. Prophecy pointed its finger at Raphael.
Shocked, he stared at her.
And you heeded it? This man's your own flesh and blood, Vera. And in your pocket you carry...
Her sideways look at him was bleak, reproving.
I know what he is, Matthias, and what I carry. So does he. He comes to this quite willing.
And you? He whispered. How willing are you, Vera, to kill?
Be silent, she commanded. Don't you understand yet? Prophecy must be served without fear or favour, or it can't be served at all. Did you think this would be easy? Did you think we'd save our innocent mage without we pay a price?
He wrapped his fingers round her wrist and gently drew her from him.
Not one this costly.
Then you're a fool, Matthias, and I wonder if I can use you at all, she retorted.
There were tears in her eyes. Seeing them, he felt ashamed. He was a fool to think she didn't know what she was doing, to think her blind to the consequences of their actions. She'd lived with them longer than he'd been alive. He picked up her hand and kissed it.
I'm sorry. I'll not question you again.
That made her smile.
Of course you will. I think that's why prophecy chose you. It's your job, and you do it well. Now hush. Rafe's close enough to hear us now, and we don't want him to see us brangling. What's waiting in Dorna will be hard enough. Let's not have him thinking we've anything on our minds but the gift he's agreed to give us.
Chapter 28. Raphael, who so eerily looked like Asher and shared family blood with Vera, appeared remarkably cheerful for a man going to his death. Up close, Matt could see he was younger than Asher by maybe a year or two, and not quite so heavily muscled. He wondered if that would make a difference. Raphael swung himself and his knapsack easily into the cart as it stopped beside him and settled himself behind the driver's seat, with his arms folded neatly along its back. Vera kissed his cheek, unsmiling.
Rafe?
He nodded, eyes warm with affection.
Vera? You ready then?
I'm ready. He had a clear, light voice, not like Asher's gravelly growling at all. Neither of his eyebrows was scarred. Hopefully Vera had brought some scissors to make a quick adjustment.
So, do you know yet how...
She pressed a finger to his lips.
Let's not think on that just now. Best you don't have the details to dwell on till they're needed.
His smile was swift and wry.
Maybe so.
Matt knew he was staring. Couldn't help it.
I'm Matt.
Good to meet a fellow circleman, Matt.
Hesitant, he shook Raphael's proffered hand.